Good.
Yeah.
All right. So now I have to go and. Okay, there we go. And then I think it will automatically go live at 3. And so here's what I thought, because it usually takes a while for people to come on if they're going to come on. So you know how I do the mystery question? I thought about doing it at the beginning.
Okay, yeah, sounds
And
good.
so and I have officially recruited my daughter, my 12-year-old, to write my cards. So we were going over questions last
Oh, I
night.
love it. That's great.
Yep. She's so funny. She is the only family member that listens to my podcast.
Oh. I feel like that's like my Emma, my 12-year-old. She's like, yeah, same. Is she your youngest?
Yeah, she's my youngest.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she the a couple years ago, she started reading the Out of My Mind series,
Yes.
and I had never read them. I honestly was a little bit like, oh no, I don't want to read that, because
Sometimes it's too close. I
sometimes,
feel that way too.
yeah,
Yeah. I'm like, oh, I do this all day.
right. And so she had read Out of My Mind probably 2 or 3 times. It was like the third time she was reading it. And I'm like, you know what? I should really reach out to Sharon Draper, because I bet she would be interested in, being on the podcast. And so sometimes it takes like months and years before someone's a guest. And I emailed, and then finally, like 6 months later, her publicist emails me and is like, hey, we'd love to set up an interview and all this stuff. And this was before the movie came out in Disney Plus. And so it just worked out. It just was all worked out. And so I recorded my daughter asking a question
That's great.
and played it for Mrs. Draper. So it was really cool.
Nice.
It was very cool. All right, so we are live. Here we go. And there's 3 people watching, so
Yes. Welcome.
welcome to Think Inclusive Now. Jenna Rufo is my special guest, and y'all, I think I've told you this before, going live is like seriously stress inducing, so I'm gonna check my stress level right here. It's not too bad, but the purpose of this is just so that we can have some dialogue, and that I can bring on some people to talk about what's going on in the field of special education and inclusive education, like right now, because there's a lot going on and a lot to unpack. There's a lot of stuff going on in the news, and we just need a space to talk about it. And so I thought, like, well, who would be a great first guest on this kind of platform? And so I texted Jenna. I'm like, hey Jenna, are you up for hanging out with me on live? And she was like, let's do it.
Yes, I can always talk about this stuff, Tim.
Exactly. So if you are a fan of the podcast and you know kind of how it goes, this isn't like a real this isn't exactly a podcast episode, but it will be uploaded into the feed and posted on our YouTube channel. But to start us off and to get people, as people come in, I wanted to start off with a mystery question. So usually I end the episodes with mystery questions. We're going to start with a mystery question. And so I have a little stack of cards. It's very, very thin at this point. And we're both going to answer this question to kind of get us warmed up here. And so this one is, many people read electronic books or ebooks. It's interesting that it's like electronic books. Do you think that takes away from the experience? So this is a really interesting, let me see if I can get that on the screen. There we go.
There you
Many
go.
people read ebooks. Do you think that that takes away from the experience? This is like very timely, because if you know Amazon is, I think tomorrow officially, the February 26, 2025, officially stopping the practice of like you can't download your books anymore onto a drive. Like you have to just leave them on Amazon. And so my buddy Mickey Mellon, who is a blogger and he has his own marketing and website company, he wrote a blog post about how to download them. And so I literally downloaded my ebooks today. they're in a file. Yeah, they're in a file on my computer. So
I'm old school. So my answer to that question is I prefer the actual book. I like to take it with me on the plane, on the beach, wherever I am. But, you know, I think it's so dependent on who you are. And especially when we think about, you know, a lot of the kids and people that we work with who have disabilities, having that accessible format is for them, that makes the experience. You know, for me, I prefer just reading it normally in that book. But for other people, the ebook, I think, is better. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm definitely a mix. I don't have a ton of ebooks. So I do have a Kindle and I do have like a stack of TB Read. And so I want to be really intentional about reading this year. So I actually started self-reg today, actually, by Stuart Shanker. Are you familiar?
No.
Okay. So do I have my Kindle here with me? Hold on. So if you're familiar, I don't know what your journey has been like with like reframing behavior or like problem behavior or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just interviewed Guy Stevens from the Alliance Against Restraint and Seclusion. And I think it was him that talked about, he doesn't even like saying challenging behavior. He likes to say stress behavior. And that is like literally in this book. So it's called Self-Reg by Stuart Shanker. And, I just started it today on my Kindle. Nice. And, it's really interesting, because I want to learn more about the, you know, neuroscience of behavior and that was recommended to me. So I'm starting that. So yeah, that's going to be interesting.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's see where we at. Okay. I think we got six people according to Facebook. So this is awesome. All right. So where I wanted to start was there was an article written by, and I'm going to share my screen. I think that's probably the best way to do this. Here we go. So I apologize for the ads. I haven't really thought that through. So hopefully nothing inappropriate comes up. Okay. So this is an article from Forbes called Reimagining IDEA, Why America's Special Education Law Needs a Modern Overhaul. And I sent this to Jenna because I really wanted to unpack it. So a friend of mine, Andrew, sent this to me. Actually, I think a number of people have sent this to me and like, hey, Tim, you need to read this. And so I was a little like, oh, gosh, I don't know what this person is going to say. But I actually really like this article. And so one of the things, and I'm not going to go through all of it. So apologize for the scrolling. But what I wanted to do was this idea of reforming IDEA. Mm-hmm. And he talks about things that are on the table. So number one, strengthening inclusion practices. I would probably call it inclusive practices, but many experts argue that IDEA should place a greater emphasis on effective inclusion strategies or effective inclusive education. I agree with that. And so streamlining IEP processes, I definitely agree with that. As a former educator, 16 years, I wrote IEPs and I was in IEP meetings. It's super inefficient. and then investing in early intervention. I don't know about this performance-based funding. I haven't really thought that through exactly, but embracing universal design for learning. So I'm wondering if just these few ideas on the table, if you have any thoughts about the author's ideas about the changes on the table for IDEA.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we are looking at reauthorizing IDEA, which at this point, who knows when that's going to happen. We've been talking about it for a long time. Last reauthorization was 2004. So we're 20 plus years now since it's been reauthorized. One of the things I think, a lot of those things on there, strengthening inclusive practices, streamlining IEPs, early intervention, UDL, of course, right? Check, 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 check. All for me. Good. I think the one piece that I'm interested in, and for me, it's not even necessarily as much the performance-based funding, but I've always felt that the funding, in addition to being underfunded, right? So we know IDEA is an underfunded mandate, never rose to the level that the federal government said it should. I think that there needs to be really a look at maybe not just that performance piece, but also educational placement. And one of the things that, I have thought a lot about is when you have a district that is more inclusive, that is engaging in these good practices so that students with disabilities can be in the general education environment. A lot of times what happens is you have families who can, right? So if you have the means, families that will move to that district, which is great. However, what happens then is then those districts that are engaging in those good practices have more financial, I don't want to say burdens because it's not a burden, but financially there is an expense, right? When you have students who have higher needs that are coming in, and then it really disincentivizes those other districts from doing anything because you know what? Oh, if we just kind of keep doing whatever we're doing, people will move out, they'll go somewhere else. Then what's the point, in trying to improve? So for me, I think the funding piece really should also be tied somewhat to placement because we have these thresholds, these indicators for educational environment where we say, so many percentage of students should be included for the majority of their day. But when that doesn't happen, there's not really a whole lot of things to say that, okay, now you're going to lose funding, or really what happens is you're in corrective action, you write a plan, and then you come off of it. So
yeah,
I think that's something to look at.
Yeah, that's so, it's so frustrating because, let me see if I can collect my thoughts here. There's this misconception, or there was, especially before this whole talk about the dissolution of the Department of Education. But there was this misconception that the feds had more control over local and state governments than they actually do.
Correct. Okay.
So there's that. And I was having this conversation, when all these executive orders were coming out, and I'm like, man, I wish that the federal government had more teeth to enforcing IDEA. Because right now, like what you said, if a state doesn't meet their requirements, right, there's corrective action. But then what?
Right. And it really falls on the individual parents to bring those claims forward. I think there's, in terms of if we're thinking of things that are happening, not necessarily across, the federal government now, but there are some scary bills that are out there in some different states. And one that I just saw recently is in Alabama, and they are looking to add an additional layer of bureaucracy, I think, to the due process methodology, if you will. So pretty much they're saying before a parent can file due process that they have to file a state complaint, go to mediation, attempt to resolve it, which, I think that's problematic for parents because nobody wants to go to due process. You don't want to get to that point. So I don't think many people do that lightly. And I'm not okay with adding an extra layer of you have to do this before you can even file a claim.
Right. And that was in Alabama?
Yes. That one was, let's see.
Yeah.
Alabama House Bill 197.
Okay,
So
so
this
everyone can go
one,
ahead and Google that.
yeah.
What I find really funny, not funny, ironic, is that in some of these more conservative leaning.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
States that you have somebody trying to add a level of bureaucracy.
Right. Yeah, I that confuses me, right? Like,
Yeah.
keep the government out of everything, and then now we're adding additional requirements. I think it's very fascinating, and I think a lot of people don't actually understand how these systems work. So, when we're thinking about Department of Education, and that's on the table to abolish it, well, the government shouldn't tell us what to teach in our schools. Well, actually, they don't. That's not the federal government, right? That's never been their role. That role is at the state and the local level. Really, the federal government involvement, from that lens, and particularly as it relates to special education, is around the enforcement of those civil rights laws. So I think that, to me, that's the scary part of if when the department is abolished, or if its powers are significantly reduced, who is looking out for the rights of some of our most vulnerable students?
I want to get back to the article
Sorry,
because
Sam, I'm
these
bird
are
walking here.
no, it's fine. It's fine. I have a feeling like we're gonna be like, oh my gosh, we're at time. because we could really talk about this forever. I want to go down and talk about reform. And so I really like what the author, and let's just cite the author because his name is Scott White, and writing for Forbes. And one of the, let me get back down to it. Sorry for the scrolling. The cost and effectiveness of reform. Critics of reform often cite cost as a barrier. However, many of the proposed changes could ultimately save money. In our experience, and I've certainly talked to you, the MCIE's CEO, our CEO, Carolyn Teaglin, who was the assistant superintendent of Cecil County Public Schools, and in your role as assistant superintendent, or I'm not sure what the exact role was for North Penn, but
Yeah, that was it.
the cost of inclusive practices, when you, I guess, look in the long term, it's actually less than segregated spaces. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I think the reason people think that it's going to be more expensive, and it can be, depending if you don't really put all of your effort behind it, it can be more expensive because you can't effectively run a dual model without hiring a whole bunch of staff. So what I mean by that is, if you have all these special education programs over here that are self-contained classrooms and we need teachers here, and then we have these kids over here and they're included, then you can't split that special ed teacher in half. So there's not really an effective way to do it. So I think there is an element of pulling all of those strings at once and saying, okay, let's look at what we can collapse to free up staff that can then support more inclusively. Because when you're running both, it's not an effective use of resources. And that, I do a lot of work with schools across the country now. And what's interesting to me is no matter where I go, what type of setting, whether it's urban, suburban, affluent, low income, nobody thinks they have enough staff, right? So
That's so true.
even when they do,
Oh my
like
gosh,
there are
yeah.
definitely places where I think, oh no, you're good. It's really, I think, a lot of times a resource allocation piece. So, more is not always better. And so when I also don't believe in just throwing money at something. So I don't believe that, oh, we need more money so we can include kids. Well, more of the same is not going to result in fundamental change. So I think, if we're funding these things, then we have to think strategically about that and how are we going to make the best use of the teachers and staff that we have.
Yeah. And I also want to bring up, I'm going to stop sharing so we can see each other. I also want to bring up this idea of fiscal responsibility, because that is a lot that that is something that is talked about a lot, right? About efficiency, fiscal responsibility. So in my experience as a teacher in segregated classes, you have one teacher, maybe one or two paraprofessionals. And in my case, I taught a kindergarten through fifth grade class. So that's six grade levels. How efficient do you think that I was in delivering instruction for my students?
Right. You weren't.
Not very efficient.
And that's not your fault. Like, that's the thing. This is, it's not a reflection on the special education teacher. It's, we put people in these positions that, you know, it's impossible.
Right. Right. Plus, you know, these regionalized programs, clumping students together, and all of this, you know,
right,
like putting in funding these classrooms are actually very expensive. You have a kind of an over representation of special education staff, either in one school or in even in a class. So one thing that I know that you've talked about, and you've written multiple books, but one of the things I'm going to bring up, because I did title this Reimagining Special Education. So the book that you wrote with with Julie Kostin, has some really great ideas about how to reallocate some of those resources. And by spreading students out across a grade level and across a school and being efficient with how to use special education staff, that is going to cut cost, and it's going to be more efficient, and it's going to be better for students. Right. For both students with and without disabilities. So I don't know. Do you want to talk about that a little bit off the top of your head?
Yeah, no, that's sure. I think when you've heard me say this before, probably, Tim, but I'm very much of the philosophy of, if you build it, they will come. So if we start creating these programs, these places where someone can go, then you're going to fill them. It isn't always even, I don't want them in my class. It's people genuinely think, you know what, there's someone else, there's someplace else, there's something else that can serve this child better than I can. And isn't it great that we have this resource that they can go to that is going to help them? But of course we know, despite what our friend Doug Fuchs is saying, you know, claiming that all of the research from the last 50 years is bogus, what we know from that research is that our students, you're laughing at me, our students with disabilities, when they're in general education, they have better outcomes, better academic achievement, more positive behavioral outcomes, better social engagement. So looking at how to reallocate, coming back to that question of, you know, how can we restructure things better? We have to reexamine the role of the special education teacher. So again, we can't just keep doing the same thing that we've always done and then expect that we're going to get different outcomes. So how can we structure that role more creatively? I'm a big proponent of having more indirect hours with the special education teacher, doing things on the front end, like supporting teachers, modifying curriculum, you know, working on coaching or supporting behaviorally. Because I think too often what happens if we have students with disabilities in general ed, teacher is pushing in, maybe she doesn't have planning time, she doesn't have enough content knowledge, whatever the barrier might be, and we're not really getting out of that person what we could. So, you know, when we have inclusive settings where the special ed teacher looks more like an aide, that's not an effective use of resources. So that's another area where you have to look at, you have to say, okay, what can we do differently here? Because co-teaching is a very expensive model to do poorly. So if you're going to invest in that, then you have to have structurally all those elements in place. You have to have training, co-planning, administrative support, all of those things to make it successful.
Ooh, I like that. Can you say that one more time about co-teaching?
It's an expensive model to do poorly. Right? Like, you've got two teachers in one room. If we're not seeing fundamentally different instruction, that's a problem.
that's a big problem. So, yeah. Y'all, one teach, one assist is we got to ditch the one teach, one assist.
For sure.
And if you don't know what that means, definitely there's a lot of, there is a lot of resources about co-teaching models. But anyways, Marilyn Friend is one that is off the top of my head. I know that Julie Costin's written books about that. I think you go over co-teaching and reimagining special education. There's so many different resources about co-teaching. And
we do. And I have to share too, Tim, that my colleague Kate Small and I are working on a co-teaching book now. So, you know, we're still a while out, but.
Okay, good, good. Yes, yes. That is definitely needed. All right, let's get back to the article. I think this is going really well. So
I'm having fun.
I'm just saying. I'm just saying. Let's see. We haven't lost anyone yet, I don't think. I need to go back here. Okay, so Scott talks about bad ideas to avoid. He says we shouldn't reduce funding, which I agree with. Over-standardizing IEPs. I think I kind of know what he means about the probably making it too simple and too rigid, because IEPs are supposed to be, unique to the student, and then eliminating, we should not be eliminating inclusion mandates. And so let's talk about this for a second, because I think I would like to talk about the maybe misconception about LRE as being this continuum of placements. And I don't remember if we've talked about this before, but so when you think about LRE, you're really thinking about general ed,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that's something that we talk about when we're with our partners, is there's not some, this like, menu of options where you have the general education classroom, and then the general education classroom with additional support, and then the general education classroom with a co-teacher, and then you have all these different options of placement. And so when you look at the needs of a particular learner, you're like, well, the LRE for this student is you know, because believe me, I've been in many IEPs where that is the language, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is that, how would you, if you were an IEP and you heard that, what would you say?
Yeah. So, and Tim, we were talking about this before, you know, everybody got on Facebook Live. So whether you want to refer to people like you and me as the inclusionists or the abolitionists, as it was called in the recent article, I think that there's a misinterpretation a lot of times about, at least I know what I stand for, I think what you stand for, what a lot of people in the field that believe in inclusion really believe to be true. And we're not saying that students don't need specialized instruction, right? So we're not saying that a student who has a decoding issue doesn't need a specific reading intervention. That's not the message. I think where the misunderstanding is we're saying, why do we need to sacrifice access to the curriculum, access to peers for intervention, when there's lots of ways that those services can be provided? So, for example, particularly at elementary schools now, most of them either have response to intervention or multi-tiered systems of support where there's an intervention block that's built into the day. And that's the time where those interventions can occur so that we're preserving the integrity of the general curriculum. So I think that's a piece of it. The other piece, I think, when we're thinking about the LRE for a student, is it's not a for this student conversation. Really where you start, where we're supposed to start, is what supplementary aids and services could we try in general education before we consider another option? So we don't say, well, because the student has an intellectual disability or because whatever the disability is, this is a more restrictive environment. That should not be the conversation. The conversation is, what are the supplementary aids and services within general ed that can help that we can consider that as the least restrictive environment. And if we can't, you know, after all of those things, we ultimately determine that, you know, there needs to be a period of the day where they're receiving instruction somewhere else, that's a different conversation than, of course, we can't do this because the student has Down syndrome or autism or whatever it is.
Right, right. Yeah, because they have Down syndrome, they have to go to an intellectual disability classroom. And, oh, isn't it so wonderful? We have, you know, look at all the fun things we do in that class. You know, and then there's five grade levels there, you know.
Right, right. And one of my...
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Colleagues, she was in a classroom in a district last week, and she said, you know, I was in the general ed class. I was, you know, supporting the teacher team there, and in walks the life skills class with, you know, their Eagles hats on and treats to hand out to everyone. And the teacher says, oh, look at these visitors. It's so nice to have you join us. And it's like, oh, that breaks my heart. Like, why are these kids visitors, right? Like they're, and why are we kind of parading around the school, serving people treats and wearing silly hats when nobody else is doing that? So, I mean, I think that's why, that's where this concern is for a lot of these separate classrooms, is what's happening there. It's, and it's not up to the standard of the education that those children deserve.
Right. Oh, that was a great, example. I love that. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. The, and it's just like, how are we presuming competence? You know,
right.
It's funny, that term, that phrase has increased exponentially. I hear it all the time now, which is great. But I really do, I challenge everyone to really think about what that means.
Right.
And how is the situation that you described, how are we presuming competence for those students? Right.
Yeah.
And by presuming competence, what I mean is, how are we saying that those students can learn what everyone else is learning in grade level curriculum when they are doing all of these things like that?
Right. Yeah. And Tim, so when I do teacher trainings, one of the things that inevitably comes up is like, well, what are they going to get out of this? And I always try to challenge that thinking a little bit, that if any of us were to reflect on, you know, the classes that we took in high school, I know I don't use most of them on a daily basis, right? But I didn't have to prove that I could get something out of chemistry or French or biology, you know, whatever it might be. That it was just assumed that I have the opportunity to explore it, and later I'll decide if I want to use it or not.
Absolutely. And I did awful in chemistry.
My mom was a chemistry teacher, so I did okay, because, you know, I had some extra support at home.
Chemistry and biology, it was awful. Psychology, I nailed it. Psychology was great. No, the other sciences, no. Math,
not
no.
So much. Yeah.
No. all right, let's go down to, wait, is that it? I think that's it. I thought there was more to that article. So let's talk about, we increased our live attendees. So that's nice. Exciting. let's talk about the, what's happening with 504. And I really appreciate the concise blog post you wrote about all the kind of different things that are happening, because there's so much going on. There's a lot going on. So do you have, could you help us understand what is happening with 504 right now with the lawsuit? Because, I mean, neither of us are lawyers, but I know that we are connected with a lot of different people. There's a lot of, it feels like there's a lot of misinformation about what's going on. People are saying in certain states, like, no, you know, this was never going to touch the, you know, the disability community or take anyone's rights. We were just talking about gender dysphoria or whatever, like that's any better. Right. Yeah. So so help us understand some of this.
Yeah. So just to back up a little bit for anyone that's maybe not familiar with what that law does. So it's Section 504 of the Vocational Rehabilitation Act. And really, it's an anti-discrimination law that says that schools or programs that accept federal funds cannot discriminate on the basis of disability. And under Section 504, disability is pretty broadly interpreted. So it can be things like asthma or ADHD or allergies, other medical issues. And what happened, so last May 2024, under the Biden administration, this is kind of where people got upset, what started this lawsuit. There was a rule that made it considered, that said gender dysphoria might be considered a physical or mental impairment. September 2024, last year, Texas Attorney General, in conjunction with 16 other states, sued, saying that the federal law explicitly excludes gender dysphoria as a disability, and they cited language in the ADA and some other court cases, and that including that was really overreach. So this case, it was called Texas v. Becerra. The other states were Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Missouri, Montana, I'm reading this list, Nebraska, South Carolina, South Dakota, Utah, and West Virginia. So on the face, what it appeared and what people were being sold was that this is about eliminating gender dysphoria as being protected under 504. However, when you scroll to the end of this lawsuit, the two of the items they were seeking for relief are one, to declare Section 504 unconstitutional, and then to prevent the defendants from enforcing Section 504. So obviously people in the disability community saw that and said, wait, you're gonna get rid of 504, we're gonna say it's unconstitutional. And some of the states, some of the lawmakers said, oh, no, that's not what we wanted to do. You know, we just don't want this gender dysphoria included here. So on the 20th, on February 20th, because there was so much outcry from the disability community, there was a joint status report that was issued. And basically what it says was the plaintiffs, so that list of states that I read, that they have never moved and they do not plan to move the court to declare Section 504 as unconstitutional on its face. What I find interesting about this is, okay, maybe that's not what you meant, but that is what you asked for. So page 42 of the complaint, demand for relief, says declare 504 unconstitutional. So right now, because of all of that public outcry, the case is stayed. And the plaintiffs are evaluating their position. So for now, it looks like things are okay, but obviously it's something we have to still be vigilant about because, you know, this is kind of buried in the law as one of the things that it was going to ask for.
Yeah. And I want to make the connection for folks too is, you know, as an organization that works with districts, around inclusive practices, like we are not equipping the teachers just to work, you know, just to think about inclusion for students with disabilities. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about inclusion and, you know, thinking inclusively about all learners. And I want to make the direct connection between learners who are experiencing gender dysphoria or who are transgender and people with disabilities, because those identities are, there's overlap and there's, mm-hmm. there's so much intersectionality, with all of these marginalized communities. And I want us to think about how ridiculous it would be for us to be like, oh, well, you just meant, right. you just wanted to, you know, not not go forward or and have like gender affirming, you know, therapies or, you know, accommodate students with gender dysphoria. But the kid with intellectual disabilities or the kid with autism, that's totally fine. Well, what happens when you have somebody that has both identities, right? it's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
And I think, Tim, to that point, so one of the things that I'm struggling with a little bit is I'll see posts or things in social media where people will say, like, you don't realize that DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, that means disability too. You know, it's not just these other groups. And I think that feels a little icky to me because it feels like, okay, well, when do we start picking and choosing like who it's okay for? So, okay, well, we're not going to do this. We're not going to talk about race. We're not going to worry about gender, all of those things, but it's okay if you include kids with disabilities. Like I have a hard time with that. I struggle. I think it's, you know, a little hypocritical to say that one group is more or less deserving than another. So I think definitely to your point about, we want to think about inclusion in a broader sense, that I don't like having to justify by saying, well, we don't mean disability, because I don't know, just it doesn't feel good to me.
No, it does not. It does not. Yeah, it's almost like people think like this is a softer sell if I say it this way.
Right.
You know, but it's like, no, actually, I don't think that makes anyone feel good in the disability community. Like, oh, OK, I'm safe.
Right. Yeah. And I think what is so interesting to me is, you know, the way the pendulum swings. So I was very much, when diversity, equity, inclusion was at the forefront, I was always advocating for, hey, let's talk about disability as part of this. And now we're kind of so far the other way where like, it's okay to talk about disability, but not these other things. So, you know, we'll see where the pendulum heads, but
yeah, I was just talking to my friend Stephen Davis from Disability Almanac about that very thing.
Yeah.
He said for years, the disability community had been knocking on the door of DEI being like, please include us. Yeah. And here we are. And here we are. Oh, that's great. That's great. So we have a little bit of time left. Thank you for explaining that 504 situation, because I think I even understand it a little bit better now that you described it the way that you did. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to open up the live stream for questions. I know that there's just a few people here, and I can see the comments on Facebook. So if you do have a question for Jenna or I about anything that we talked about or anything at all, please go ahead and put it in the comments. And I believe that I'll be able to find it. While people are, you know, catching up with the live stream about that, let me think if I have, something I wanted to ask you. I think a lot of people want to know what to do. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people feel like things are out of their control. There's so much going on. There's so much news to catch up with, like what's being funded, what's being defunded. You know, all the news, it's just, you know, it's just a lot to take in. So a lot of people are asking, you know, what can I do? What can I do right now? So do you have, are there things that you're doing or things or advice for people to do right now to kind of move things forward?
I think you have to contact your legislators. And if we look at 504 and the about face that happened with that, when so many people did, it matters. So I think with any of these things, if it's 504, Medicaid, Department of Ed, any state specific bills, it's really critical to reach out and to express that, you know, I'm your constituent. This is how I feel on this. This is why it's important. I think that that's what we have to do the most. you had mentioned the one blog post I did, Tim. I tried to link in there specific resources that people could click on. So, you know, here's a resource to find your legislator, or here's, you know, what you can say, some language around some of these things. So that information is there, because I know I was feeling very overwhelmed, and every morning kind of waking up and thinking like, oh God, what's going to happen today? Right. So I'm trying to keep that updated and in one place. If people want to go check that out, I do have some links for contacting legislators.
Yes. And let's go ahead and share that to you while I have the, while I have it up. I think I was scrolling through Facebook that morning.
Yeah.
and so I saw the name of the title. I'm like, I just started laughing because that is exactly how it feels.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So the article is "What Fresh Hell Is This? Threats to Disability Rights." And you can find that in poweredschool.org. And that is also Jenna's organization. So make sure you get on her email list. It's fantastic. And check out all the services that she has to offer. Let me see if I can go down to what you can do. Oh, I see. You have under the topic. So you have like, for instance, threats to Medicaid, mm-hmm. right? What's happening, and then why people are concerned, and then what you can do. And so, yeah, so this is great. This is fantastic. A really excellent resource for you to check out. Sorry for the scrolling, but check that out. Yeah, I think some of these House bills have gone by the wayside, right?
Yeah, Oklahoma has. I think New Hampshire, there was significant opposition to it. But I think it's still somewhere in the system. It's not completely dead yet.
Right. Right. Exactly. And it sounds like, there's just a lot to keep up with. There's a lot to keep up with, like at the state level, you know, I was just at the state capitol, and if you didn't know this, I live in Georgia, even though I work for the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. I live in Georgia, so my state representatives are in Georgia. And I was down at the Capitol because I was interviewing a parent who has really taken it upon herself to talk to like the mayor of her city, mm-hmm. Her state reps about inclusive education. And I don't think I've ever seen someone so passionate about like using local government in a way to express like how she feels about inclusive ed. So I think that was really exciting to see. So I went down and I interviewed her and was there, and that'll be coming out next week. I'm going to talk about that in my article in the weekly-ish article next week for MCIE. It was a really interesting experience. Have you ever been to your state capital, Jenna?
Yes, I have, in Harrisburg. Yep, I'm in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Yeah, it was, I had never experienced that before. Mm-hmm. And I also didn't realize that the state legislative session is only a few months long. And I don't know what it's like in other states, but in Georgia, I think it's like from January to March. And I'm like, really? That's it. Yeah. So it really, really interesting. And there was like a bunch of people running around and everyone's like, you know, chatting each other up, and they ring this bell like when it's time to vote. And it's like really, really interesting. But I think that, you know, anyone can go down to their state capitol and talk to any of their representatives. In fact, they don't even have to talk with their representatives. You can talk with any representative mm-hmm. in the state. At least that's the way it was. That's the way it was explained to me in Georgia. So, you know, I encourage you to participate, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah. Let me see if there's any questions. I don't think there is. Or at least If there is, I can't find them. So let me see here. I'll just give a shout out to the people who wrote something. So Katie, I'm going to say Huff, but I don't know if that's true. It's H-O-U-G-H. Hello from Oklahoma. So hello from Oklahoma. Thank you for being here.
Well, there's Tim a lot Kretschmann. Going on in Oklahoma now.
There is a lot going on in Oklahoma. Exactly. Tim Kretschmann, thank you for being here. Hello, everyone. Thank you for your work. Really appreciate that. And those are the only two comments we have. But
all right.
Awesome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, anytime, Tim.
Yeah, this was great. This was great. So a couple bits of housekeeping. This will be posted on Facebook. Facebook just, I think, announced that live videos will only stay up for a certain length of time. So what we're going to do is I'm going to take the video, produce it as a podcast episode. So that will be in our feed eventually. And then I'll post the video that is created onto YouTube. So that way we'll have it as an archive. But I think this went really well. Next time, we'll probably do it in a couple weeks, maybe like, it won't be every week, but maybe every couple weeks, and try to bring up some current issues, what's going on, to keep everybody informed and talk about some of the things that we talked about regarding inclusive education. So look out for that and make sure you sign up to on Jenna's email list on her website, Empower Ed School. Hold on. EmpoweredEdSchool.org. Sign up there. Mm-hmm. And then MCIE.org. Just scroll all the way to the bottom of the website and sign up for our email list. And then you can stay up to date. So thank you so much. And
thank you.
We'll sign off. All right. See you later.
All right. Bye.